Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, CMS Superintendent Crystal Hill has been placed on paid leave. Details are sketchy, but School Board Chair Stephanie Sneed says they're looking into how the district has been operated.
It is enough for us to take action.
City Council has narrowed the field of candidates for interim mayor from 110 applicants to 5 finalists, among them City Council member James Mitchell.
I'll be ready to go on day one.
A state senator warned cities and towns that voted no on the I-77 toll lanes they may have to pay back the money already spent, so Monroe rethinks their vote.
That vote could cost us $133.6 million.
And the Carolina Hurricanes win the Stanley Cup. Here to fill us in on those stories and more is WFAE politics reporter Steve Harrison. Ben Thompson is an anchor for WCNC-TV. Ryan Pitkin is co-founder and editor of Queen City Nerve. And Eric Spanberg is managing editor of the Charlotte Business Journal. Welcome to you all. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good to have you here.
Morning.
So, Ben, the Charlotte-Mecklenburg School Board announced late Wednesday that CMS Superintendent Dr. Crystal Hill had been placed on paid leave pending an investigation into how the district is run. I was going to call this a shocker, but I'm not sure that it is, because we kind of got a whiff of this when they rejected her initial budget and had a kind of a terse exchange in that session. But then they, a couple of weeks ago, unanimously approved that budget and praised her to the hilt. Was this expected?
I guess to some extent, you know, some newsrooms in the city have had a cottage industry of the turnover of CMS superintendent, but that has changed in recent years. You know, things have been going smoothly until, as you mentioned, like April, and that was our first sort of hint that there might be something going on. It was a very public spat at the school board meeting during the budget process. They initially rejected her budget. The boards had a number of closed door personnel matter meetings. And it has been noted that Dr. Hill wasn't at some of the graduation ceremonies recently. So I would say things were going appearingly swimmingly in the last several years until about a month or two ago when we started getting the hint that there might be something up.
After the board rejected her first budget, they seemed to bend over backward to praise her, maybe not her budget, but her and what she's done for the district. And then they accepted her revised budget, as I said, unanimously. And this suspension was also a bit sugar-coated. CMS Board Chair Stephanie Sneed.
It is enough for us to take action. We believe Dr. Hill has done great work, and that is evidence throughout the district. But they're also, I mean, we still have to uplift or uphold our responsibilities as elected officials.
So do we know exactly what they're looking into? There have been rumors floating around and published in the Charlotte Observer about perhaps it was her top-down leadership, my way or the highway leadership, that got her into this. And I don't know if that's true or not.
Well, I mean, you hear from even some school board members, and you can hear sort of thoughts of motives. But as far as the actual nature of the investigation, we don't have anything official. We just know it's into administrative and operational oversight is what they've actually said. But to your point, Melissa Easley came out, board member, said there was a culture of fear, said she won't miss the condescension of her. Critics have also argued there's 2 months reliance on, say, outside consultant groups as well. So critics certainly have, you know, their ammunition that they're using. We're just not clear if that's really the reason behind the investigation.
Eric.
I think it's interesting. You know, Ben said it has been a time of harmony, relatively speaking. It's almost comical. Think about it. That's 3 years. 3 years for Charlotte not having a superintendent turnover. Those are the good old days. We've had 7, I think, in the last 15 years. And you almost wonder, or not almost wonder, it's easy to assume that these just aren't long-term jobs. They're football coach jobs. Someone comes in for a few years and then they're gone. It seems inevitable.
Is that the trend around the country, that school board school superintendents don't last that long in the jobs that they accept? Is that kind of a trend? It is my impression that that is in fact the case. No?
I honestly don't know. I would be tempted to say that sometimes when I think about when I first came and started covering news here 20 years ago, Peter Gorman was superintendent, I think, for 5 years here and left for a prestigious job at the time, a lucrative job at the time. But I mean, now you have people in this position making $400,000 a year. It is a lucrative job by all accounts. Not to say there's not another one out there that's more lucrative, but it's already a high paying job as it is. She's on par with the president of the United States as far as salary.
I think though, Mike, there is a little bit of job hopping because, you know, if you run a school district this size or comparable cities, as Ben says, you're going to make $300,000-$400,000 a year. Once you kind of wear out your welcome, I'm not saying necessarily in this specific case, but once you wear out your welcome with the school board, whether you're pushed out or just tired of it, a lot of times you can jump to another comparable school district and make the same amount of money.
So we have had this history of showing superintendents the door relatively quickly. Ernest Winston, her immediate predecessor, was fired after less than 3 years, but he didn't have a lot of experience. Before that, Clayton Wilcox served just over 2 years. Heath Morrison was in the job for just over 2 years and resigned under pressure, also from board concerns over his conduct and the way he conducted his staff. We were never officially told the reasons, I don't believe, on any of these departures, but news reports indicated that Heath was going to be fired anyway for allegedly misleading the board on cost overruns and for allegedly verbally abusing and belittling employees. Began serving in 2023, so she's been on the job for around 3 years. These are all public employees. They all work with children. Shouldn't we know the reasons why they are fired or leave early or are asked to resign? Shouldn't we know?
Yeah, Mike, I think it's a great question. So in North Carolina, they're some states like Florida, a personnel file is a public document. That's not the case in North Carolina. Now, on the municipal side, like on cities and towns, and I think this applies to school boards as well, school districts, the elected officials can vote to release a personnel file in the case of public interest. If there's enough pressure and people concerned from the community, that can be put out to kind of put everyone at ease. And it will be interesting to see in this situation whether there is a call for that. Dr. Hill, of course, can do it on her own. It's her personnel file. But it will be interesting to see if there's some pressure to give a little bit of transparency on this, given all of the things that you just listed in that question.
What has Crystal Hill had to say about all of this? Anything?
It's been limited. I mean, she issued a statement saying that she's saddened by the whole thing, but she's cooperating. And she gave the impression that she says she's committed to the district, its mission, going forward in the future. So it doesn't sound like she's making any sort of plans to go somewhere else, at least not with that statement.
So as one of you mentioned that former CMS board member Melissa Easley has accused Hill of fostering a culture where educators and administrators felt discouraged from speaking openly, calling her a bully. Those are her words. Easley lost her bid for re-election this past year, but that means that the board must have known about this and yet still voted last December to extend her contract to June 30th, 2029 and give her a 7% pay raise, which brings her salary to $340,700 with total compensation, including benefits of $405,691 and some cents. I'm not sure why the cents are in there. The Observer looked at her contract and reported yesterday that we would likely owe her up to a year's salary if she's removed without cause. In this county, we seem to have made a habit of praising leaders, giving them contract extensions and raises, and then shoving them out the door 6 months later. Is that likely to happen here?
I think it's going to depend really on what the investigation finds, which we're expecting to take a few weeks, because the result of that investigation is going to lead to whatever happens. And the reasoning, if she's dismissed or if she's kept, it will sort of all come down to what the result of the investigation is.
Okay. Well, stay tuned. More to come. 110 people applied to be the interim mayor of Charlotte when Vi Lyle steps down at the end of this month. City Council, which will make the final decision, has narrowed the field to 5. Who are they? Steve?
We've got Mayor Pro Tem James Mitchell, former Mecklenburg Commissioner and City Council Member Harold Cogdell, Carrie Cook, who was recently a vice president at the Federal Reserve, Rob Harrington, an attorney, and State Senator Caleb Tedros.
And yesterday, I believe, they heard from those 5 candidates to make their final pitches. Are they definitely the only 5 who will be considered at this point, or could they could somebody come in at the very end and take the job?
I guess in theory someone could, but I think it's going to be someone from that 5.
Former
is everything I'm hearing.
Former Charlotte Mayor Jennifer Roberts was the first to volunteer to be Lyle's replacement, promising not to run in the next election, but she did not make the cut. She has the experience. Do we understand what happened there?
She was not able to make it to this Monday's forum where they were able to address city council members. I think a lot of these council members already know who Jennifer Roberts is, to the point where they had a little bit of back and forth on Monday about as to whether anyone was going to nominate folks who did not show up. Apparently she had some prior commitments and couldn't make it. But she only ended up with 1 vote. Each council member had to give in their list of 3 top candidates for the city staff to make 5 top vote getters out of that. And she only got 1 single nomination from Dimple Ejmera. So she didn't get a ton of support, despite her lobbying through Charlotte Squawks' show this year. Didn't quite work out for her.
So ranked choice voting has taken place at the city council. Meanwhile, as Steve mentioned, Mayor Pro Tem James Mitchell is among the finalists, and he said this to WMRT.
We have created a lot of momentum. We've worked on a lot of relationships. And 18 months for the 14th largest city, I'll be ready to go on day one.
Would he be considered the front runner, Steve?
It's a good question. He certainly has a solid 4 votes, including himself. There was a bit of controversy whether Councilmember Mitchell would be allowed to participate in the process. It's up to him to recuse himself. He's decided not to. James Mitchell is known as kind of a deal maker. You know, that's what he likes to do, is bring people together and get to 6 votes. This will be, over the weekend, his ultimate test of that, to try and get to 6, because I don't think at this moment he has 6 votes. We will see if he can kind of, you know, make the magic happen over the weekend before Monday's vote.
And also speaking to WBTV, State Senator Caleb Tedros also applied, and he is also among the 5 finalists.
I'm trying to go wherever the need is, especially at the city of Charlotte, where the 14th largest growing city in the country.
That sounds like an explanation, but why would you give up a state Senate seat to be the interim mayor of Charlotte with a promise not to run for re-election?
Well, it is a better commute. It's a better commute.
It's a better commute. It's a much better paycheck.
Is it really?
$13,000 a year to $80,000?
Okay. Well, they gave dozens of candidates gave their 2-minute pitches before council this week, and then they narrowed it down to the 5 that we've been talking about. Was that meeting open to the public, by the way, where they gave their pitches?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
And the city council is set to announce their final decision. I'm assuming it's their final decision on Monday, correct?
Yes, during their regular meeting on Monday
night. So before we move on, Ben, you have your hand up.
So just before I came on with you, I spoke to Robert Harrington, one of the candidates. He's billing himself as sort of the outsider. He's the lesser known guy in this. He said he thinks part of the big, big deal here is the promise not to run again.
Okay. Well, we'll see what happens. We come back. We're going to talk about the I-77 toll lanes and the shifting sands underneath the decision they made a couple of weeks ago to say no. It's Charlotte Talks. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're here with Steve Harrison, WFAE's politics reporter. Ben Thompson is an anchor for WCNC-TV. Ryan Pitkin, co-founder and editor of Queen City Nerve. And Eric Spanberg is managing editor of the Charlotte Business Journal. The vote to reject the I-77 toll lanes by the City of Charlotte and other members of the Charlotte Regional Transportation Planning Organization seems to be teetering a bit following a draft proactive legislation by Mecklenburg-Iredell Republican State Senator Vicky Sawyer that would require those that voted no to pay back the $60 million already spent.
I want you to know that this is just as friendly as I can be, a warning to all of you to reconsider.
Friendly. That was introduced as an amendment to the Department of Transportation omnibus bill. Has that bill or the amendment gotten any traction in Raleigh, Steve?
So the Sawyer amendment was not placed in that omnibus bill during a committee hearing this week. But that doesn't mean, I mean, I think it's still going to happen. It looks like it's going to be inserted into the state budget. So, you know, this little pause, if you are opposed to the 77 toll lanes, I don't think you should read too much into that as a victory.
Sawyer's amendment would require Charlotte and other local governments to repay the money already spent based on their share of the weighted vote. And the way the CRTPO works is that Charlotte has the bulk of the vote, so we'd be paying a lot of money back. But the fact that anybody has to pay anything back if this bill passes caught the attention of Monroe City Council's David Dotson.
That vote could cost us $133.6 million without any input from the staff that I know of, without any input from us as elected officials for the city of Monroe.
And with that, Monroe City Council voted to rescind their no vote. Has that caused, Eric, any ripples around the region?
Well, I think that all of the local governments obviously have the same worry, and that's the point of this amendment that Senator Sawyer has introduced, is in her amendment, it would either enforce that penalty, or you would have until January 1st of 2027 to rethink, so to speak. So it is certainly a carrot and stick maneuver. Now, we've heard from Mecklenburg County Vice Chair Lee Altman and others, including the town attorney of Matthews, that this is unconstitutional, that this is punitive, that it is retroactive. And Lee Altman has sent a letter to NCDOT saying there are 12 other instances of regions dropping projects and not being penalized in this way. So Mecklenburg is in essence being singled out. So Mike, I think what I'm trying to say in a very long-winded way is there's a long fight ahead.
Yeah, that's where I was going with this, because Sawyer has called her amendment, to use your word, a stick to get Charlotte and others to change their minds and back the toll lanes. Meanwhile, an attorney for the town of Matthews has called the proposed legislation unlawful, adding that the amendment offends due process and attacks local governments for listening to constituents. And as you said, Mecklenburg County Commissioner Lee Altman made this comment to explain that body's decision to hold firm to their no vote.
This would create a new precedent that DOT could turn around and assess fees against any municipality in the state if they can do this to Mecklenburg County.
And Governor Josh Stein told a Charlotte audience this week that he believes local leaders can find a solution without threats.
There's a lot of people ride on that road. There's a lot of traffic. There are a lot of accidents. We need to make it safer. But we also have to do it in a way that's sensitive to the local communities. And I believe that Charlotte can find a path forward. I don't think that threats are the best way to get to a desirable outcome.
It should be noted. Well, I'll let you make your comment, Steve, before I go on. Go ahead.
Yeah, I think it's interesting that comment you played from Governor Stein. He has really sat this controversy out. He runs the Department of Transportation. He is the one ultimately in charge. And if you listen to that quote you just played, he talked about Charlotte can find a solution. It's like, well, you know, he could direct his DOT to look for alternatives. He could direct them to do X, Y, and Z, but he doesn't. And he has, you know, I think Governor Stein wants the project to move forward. So his public statements are always kind of couched with this, like, we need to do something. Threats aren't a good way. But again, it's not what he says. It's what he's not saying. I think that's really important.
It should be noted that the senator who is pushing this, Senator Sawyer, opposes the I-77 toll lanes north of the city. She has called them predatory and doesn't like the fact that the revenue goes to a foreign company, Cintra, out of, I think, Spain. They built and they manage those lanes.
This is something that my community has called for over and over again in regards to predatory lane and predatory tolls that affect our community.
So why does she want to saddle citizens with the toll lanes south on I-77? Eric.
Well, it's interesting. Lee Altman responded to that by saying, make it make sense. On the one hand, you want to get rid of the toll lanes in your own district, and on the other, you want to force it onto the southern part of the district. What Senator Sawyer has said is that leadership is going to take action on this, and she is, as you played the clip, sort of providing a warning and transparency that Mecklenburg County has to act in some way. But it is all but impossible to hear the juxtaposition of getting rid of the North and enforcing the South and thinking anything but, what are we doing here?
It's the Civil War all over again. Steve, go ahead.
Yeah, and I was reading an email that Senator Sawyer sent a resident of Mercury Heights this week. And in that email, she said, well, I don't like the 77 South project either. So again, it's very puzzling. We don't like 77 North. We don't like 77 South, but I'm going to force it through. And this idea that Senator Sawyer has been casting herself as like, look, I'm trying to help you. I'm trying to help you on this with, to let you know. And, you know, there is a lack of transparency in Raleigh, clearly. But at some point, if there is a actual law that requires Charlotte to pay this back, it's going to be public. I mean, this idea that we're getting a heads up, I don't really see the benefit of that. The anything that is in the omnibus bill or the budget eventually will be written down and made public. So I'm not quite seeing the favor here for local governments. It's not going to be a secret.
Mike, at some point as we delve into this over the next 39 years, we're going to get into the idea I've mentioned earlier, Sawyer's proposal that the area would have until January 1st before the money comes out of the state transportation fund, the $600 million that would go toward this project with the private money. At the same time, the North Carolina Department of Transportation Board is scheduled to vote to remove that $600 million at its August 8th meeting. Now, obviously, these things can change, but that's a subplot to this conversation. Is the amendment going to take precedent? Is the NCDOT board going to take that action? And as with all of these things, there are a million codicils of federal requirement and state law and what can be done and what can't be done. So here we sit.
Okay, another story to stay tuned for because it's going to go on all summer and probably into the fall. Reverberations from the death of 6-year-old Dominique Moody last December in Mecklenburg County are still being felt. She died after police found that she was starved, beaten, and allegedly forced to live in a dog crate. This after a state investigation found evidence of multiple reports of alleged abuse and neglect that were ignored. State Representative Carla Cunningham.
But it's what is so interesting is that there were 5 cases that later went to 13 cases where people had called in and reported incidents at this residence, and they were all unsubstantiated. And so we don't want that to happen again.
One child welfare expert has called what happened, quote, incredibly preventable. And this week, the House unanimously approved a new child welfare set of regulations. What do they include, Ben?
It would basically create a quicker warning system that would sort of alert state officials in a faster way that there are warning signs in specific cases like this one, because they say the system, by all accounts, failed her in this situation. So they would have what they're calling a state-level child welfare escalation team that would review high-risk cases when red flags keep on piling up and they repeatedly come up, and create more oversight over cases like this, hoping to catch them when they otherwise are falling through the cracks.
Are investigators just looking into this case, or are they looking into other cases? In other words, is this a one-off? Is this an extraordinary situation that has only happened once, or could it have been happening and still happening repeatedly in other cases and we just don't know about it?
I think the sheer nature of this case and how horrible it is getting the attention and why this bill is being named for her. But I think there's also an acknowledgement that if this can happen in one place and to one child, that this could certainly happen in other places, which is why state lawmakers are getting involved.
So it passed unanimously in the House. It goes to the Senate next. Do we know what their feelings are about this bill? Any idea?
I think there's support. It's not, I'm not quite sure if it's unanimous yet, like it is in the House. I think the big question over this is, would more documentation, which this bill calls for, more photos, more video, that sort of thing, is that going to be enough to compensate for agencies that are in many cases already seeing staffing shortages, they're already seeing heavy workloads, and they're already seeing a lot of turnover. And this bill wouldn't exactly address that. And so a lot of people say probably it's not going to go far enough with agencies that are already struggling.
So the North Carolina House is also considering sweeping elections bill that is being pushed back on by Democrats. What does that bill propose, Ben?
This is not just a tweak. This is pretty sweeping. It would change the way that votes can be not counted necessarily, but challenged, audited, that sort of thing. And I think you've got to ask yourself, are you saying that there's a problem with the way the elections are run right now in North Carolina? Has there been fraud? Because a lot of people will say this is an answer, you know, a problem looking for a solution. But it would allow the state auditor to audit any county. You know, supporters will say, oh, well, that's good. That's, you know, gives transparency. Critics will say that gives one elected person who didn't have control, by the way, over elections until just a few years ago, way too much power to interfere with local elections. It also, I mean, on the upside, it does give absentee voters a few more days to fix problems. Again, a lot of folks are wondering if this is really necessary.
It also allows any resident of a county to challenge another resident's ballot until 5 days after the election. That seems like a formula to create chaos. It also would ban people who have never lived in the state from voting here. Who would they be, the people who have never lived? The sons and daughters of military folks who are overseas?
People overseas, yep, that's exactly
so
what.
So where are they
about.
Supposed to vote?
It's not exactly clear. If they're making accommodations for those people, or if those people are going to just sort of miss out. It's a part of the problem that a lot of people are pointing out.
Okay, well, we'll see what happens there too. In the Senate, they are considering putting a cap on how much nonprofit hospital CEOs can be paid. That's causing a shudder, I'm sure. This is part of a broader health care bill that passed committee this week. Republican Senator Jim Bergen of Hartnett County says hospital CEOs should have their pay capped at a level based on their lowest paid employee.
That means if a hospital's lowest paid full-time employee makes $35,000 a year, the hospital CEO's compensation will be capped at 400 times that amount, or $14 million annually.
So where is this coming from, Eric? Why now?
Well, I think it's because of the pending WakeMed Atrium Health merger in the Triangle area. And as many of us on this show know and listening, Atrium Health is part of Advocate Health, which is based in Charlotte. The CEO of Atrium Health, Gene Woods, received compensation of $26 million, or nearly $26 million, in the most recent reports. And so I think it's a pretty straight line from that merger, his pay, to the General Assembly.
So he makes, to be exact, $25.8 million a year in total compensation, but that includes a base salary of $4.6 million, bonus and incentive pay of $14.4 million, other compensation of $3.8 million. Probably a car allowance, and a retirement and deferred compensation of $2.9 million. So really, will this cap apply to total compensation or just his $4.6 million salary? In other words, will he be hit by this cap?
That's what I'm curious about, Mike. When this bill, assuming that this bill makes it through, can you stop bonuses and other compensation? And to what degree can you stop those? Because there's a big difference between what the senator just said about salary and 14 times the lowest paid amount. So This is going to be tricky. As with all these matters in Raleigh, it seems so straightforward, and then all of a sudden you start to look at it and say, well, is that going to fix the problem you're trying to fix?
Well, rising concerns over data centers have resulted in moratoria on new centers in several areas, including Mecklenburg County, where they put a 150-day moratorium in place. I think it takes it till November. Aside from concerns over water consumption and noise pollution and the fact that these centers tend to result in increase of electric rates for ratepayers, they, like other businesses, often receive tax incentives for locating in a certain area, even though they don't employ a lot of people. Now, Governor Stein wants to repeal those incentives at the state level. Ryan, that wouldn't happen until 2032. If it's so important, why wait?
Well, the 2032 would sort of be the sunset of all exemptions, but under Stein's plan, which has not really been created into a bill yet, it's still in the works, but under this plan, some of the things would roll out a little quicker than that, specifically the energy usage exemption. And I think that's one of the biggest things that people see is, these data centers come online and they start sucking up all the energy uses at a time when they're already trying to raise the rates on us. That's going to be the first priority that could happen within about a year if this bill does, put in front of lawmakers and pass.
Stein wants to end the exemption on electricity by the end of this year, which would be the deadline for data centers to apply for an exemption from the North Carolina sales tax, saying it's unfair for taxpayers to subsidize data centers' energy use. Mecklenburg Democratic Representative Terry Brown added this.
While we're rolling out the welcome wagon, we want to make sure that we're not losing our shirt at the same time.
So is this a bipartisan issue, or is movement being led mostly by Democrats, Ryan?
This is something even Phil Berger has spoken, if not fully in support of. He's definitely been on board and wants to look more into this. We've spoken before on this show about the fact that counties and municipalities all across the state, regardless of whether run red or blue, are all sort of passing these moratoriums and having holdups on all of these. So it is definitely a bipartisan effort.
Well, there's a Republican primary, a runoff primary going on in South Carolina. Early voting is underway. They vote officially on Tuesday for the next governor candidate from the Republican Party, and we'll look into what's going on down there in just a moment. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. Steve Harrison's with us, WFAE's politics reporter. Ben Thompson, anchor at WCNC-TV. Ryan Pitkin, co-founder and editor of Queen City Nerve. And Eric Spanberg, managing editor of the Charlotte Business Journal. Well, there's a runoff going on south of us in the Palmetto State for the South Carolina governor's race, which is heating up on the Republican side. In what was described as a raucous debate at Coastal Carolina University this week, South Carolina Lieutenant Governor Pam Evatt and State Attorney General Alan Wilson traded jabs about each other's ads. First, Pam Evatt.
Mudslinging comes when the attorney general and his PACs and people put me on a television screen with drag queens. I have never met a drag queen. I've never met AOC. And for the record, I've never taken a lie detector test. That's mudslinging.
Attorney General Alan Wilson.
You don't want someone who's going to cut backroom deals to try to get the next job. You want someone who will fight for your family. You don't want someone who will run ridiculous lies and commercials to try to manipulate you. You want someone who will tell you the truth, and I will be that person.
So Evatt has been endorsed by South Carolina Governor Henry McMaster and by Donald Trump, and led in the primary with 29% of the vote. Alan Wilson finished with about 26% of that vote. What are pundits saying about who may pick up the votes of people who voted for other candidates? Steve, do we know?
It looks like the Attorney General Wilson has some momentum. He has been endorsed by Congress members Ralph Norman and Nancy Mace, Texas Senator Ted Cruz. And there's some talk that President Trump may, in a way, pull back his endorsement of the lieutenant governor and endorse both. Trump doesn't like to lose, obviously. And so he's done that in the past where he endorses both candidates. So I think the main takeaway is that Tuesday looks obviously really, really close. And no one's quite sure who's going to be on top.
Well, one of the individuals who did not make the cut was Nancy Mace, who on election night threw her support to Wilson. And this week, Wilson took advantage of that endorsement.
Now, maybe some of you may have supported
Nancy Mace. All right, she's a maverick. She shakes things up. She could be off putting to some people. But some people like that. And if you voted for her because of that, you have a home with me.
Meanwhile, another politician who lost his bid, Ralph Norman from Rock Hill, has also endorsed Alan Wilson.
Talking to Pamela, I just couldn't get a clear vision. With Alan, I did. He was here yesterday on Sunday. He was genuinely concerned about his future. He bought into the ideas that we have. So it was tough. I didn't decide till late last night.
I don't know if you can answer this question, Ben, but will these endorsements help Alan Wilson?
I mean, they won't hurt, but I think the bigger issue is that, I mean, we're in the middle of June in South Carolina. Who is voting? Turnout is going to be a big deal. And early voting is going on right now, and Tuesday is the actual runoff day. But, I mean, turnout, I assume, is going to be abysmal for something like this. So I think political, you know, if we had Bitzer on here right now, he'd probably say it's all about turnout. Who's going to get turnout? And I think that's probably true. I'm not an expert like he is, but I think that's what he'd probably say, because it's going to be such a small turnout. If one camp can get more people out, and if Ralph Norman and Nancy Mace does that for the voters and gets more people out, then honestly, that's going to be more determinative than anything.
The Bitzer you refer to is Michael Bitzer, who's a professor of politics and history at Catawba College and a go-to guy in media for all things politics. On Monday, the Cabarrus County Commission voted to approve a Juneteenth proclamation. Today is Juneteenth. Commissioner Larry Pittman was the sole member voting against that proclamation.
First of all, I want to address this thing about Juneteenth. I don't support it because it is based on a lie.
Now, he argued that the Emancipation Proclamation did not free all enslaved people, and he is correct in that assessment. The proclamation was an executive order at the time, signed by President Abraham Lincoln, declaring that all enslaved people in the states in rebellion, i.e. the Confederacy, henceforward shall be free. But it did not free enslaved people in Union states or in territories or Confederate states controlled by the Union Army. This is really getting into the weeds here, but I just want to, he's been maligned for what he said, and it's not necessarily fair. Texas was still in rebellion on June 19, 1863. Pittman argued that because slaves in Union states were still being enslaved after June 19th, the real date for celebration for the slaves being set free should be December the 6th, 1865, because that was the date they ratified the 13th Amendment to the Constitution, ending slavery. Pittman says if you want to celebrate the freeing of slaves, he wants to celebrate with you, but do it on the right date. He seems to be a stickler for history.
True history is important, not what an elitist point of view forces to be taught in schools and ignores the real truth of what happened.
And do you admit this?
And my son, hey, it is not your turn, sir.
And this is where the argument starts to go off the rails. He told the crowd that his son is a history teacher.
And it makes me sick what passes for history that is falsehood. And I will not just sit by and take it. I guess I've said enough. You've said enough, boy.
Boy!
And with that, the gavel stopped it all. Do we know if the person he referred to as boy was African-American? Do we know?
I sure would like to. I'd like to put some context into his comments in the sense that, let's go back to 2017 when Larry Pittman himself called Abraham Lincoln just as bad a tyrant as Hitler. So he's speaking from the context of someone that I don't necessarily believe does want to celebrate the end of slavery. It's sort of a lot of his remarks sound like just someone who's trying to be the smartest guy in the room when it is known that this day has been celebrated by African-Americans beginning the year after it happened, when this order was designated in Texas as Freedom Day. It has a very rich history as being celebrated on that day. So all of his, what he's trying to do is a lot of just sort of policing based on his own beliefs of when someone should celebrate something that's been celebrated
and
for a long time.
As I understand it, when the Union Army arrived in Texas, the enslaved people there did not know that the Emancipation Proclamation had been signed, freeing slaves in the Confederate States, and they were informed by that Union official, and therefore that's the day they commemorated. And to be fair about all of this, to be totally accurate, the Continental Congress voted for independence on July 2nd. They officially adopted the declaration on July 4th, but they didn't sign it until August 2nd. So which day should we observe?
Oh, Mike's I'll leave taking that as our fireworks. Question. Mike Collins has taken your fireworks. It just happened.
All right, we're moving on here. The YMCA of Greater Charlotte has decided to sell its Morrison Family Center in Ballantyne for $42.5 million. Eric, why?
The CEO of the YMCA says they need the money to invest in a $100 million facility upgrade across the YMCA system in Charlotte, and this will obviously pay nearly half of that amount. They also say they have enough supporting facilities nearby to make this move, and it's interesting, Mike, the buyer, the church that's buying this, is relatively new, started by David Chadwick, who had started Forest Hill many years ago.
Yeah, this is a relatively new church. How big is it? Because this is, A, it's a big building, but B, $42.5 million is a big sum of money.
Yeah, that's a good question. I do not know the finances of, is the church, is it Moments of Hope Church? I think it was started in 2019, relatively soon after David Chadwick had left Forest Hill after 39 years. That was a pretty big deal in the local faith community. And they say that they are going to use it for a combination of sports programming, community outreach, and worship, which would all start next summer. So the Morrison Y will stay open as is until then.
And because they're closing, that's caused some, bad vibes among the people who use that Y as a Y. YMCA President and CEO Sue Glass acknowledged this is troublesome to some members and wants to make sure members can voice their concerns. She said, quote, allowing them to be able to have a voice or at least help listen in regards to what their concerns are is going to be really important for us. But Ryan, the decision has already been made, right? So what's the point?
That's political speak, I guess. Well, we will show you your Google Maps app and find you where the closest Y is. And that's about as much help as they're likely to offer, I'd say.
We've been through this before, and you've reported on this before, Ryan. In 2022, the Johnston YMCA in Noda was slated to be sold, which got a lot of people upset. And then the sale fell through. Are there parallels there to what's happening right now in Ballantyne?
Well, there are relations. It does have to do with their whole reimagining of their system. And there's also that $100 million investment you said, a big part of that is going to renovating the YMCA, Johnston YMCA in Noda. They're redoing some of the buildings there. So it's all connected, that's for sure.
Okay. The International Military Sports Council's Military World Games selected Charlotte as the host site for what some say is bigger in scope than the Olympics. I'm trying to wrap my head around that, but that's what I was told the other day by somebody. When are they scheduled and where will these games be played, Eric?
So it's a 10-day event, June 25th through July 4th next summer. The sites are still being considered, but UNC Charlotte, Memorial Stadium, Charlotte Motor Speedway are likely to be part of these games. But at the same time, other sites further afield in both North and South Carolina are also going to be used. There was a site visit, I believe, in April, with a delegation from the group that you just mentioned. And Mike, it is an Olympic-style competition featuring active military members from all over the world. It's been going on for roughly 30 years. They expect a delegation of 8,000 to 10,000 athletes, but I don't know that I would make the direct comparison to the size and scope economically of an Olympics, but clearly there are some who are doing that.
So when you say active military personnel from all over the world, are they all U.S. military or are they from other nations as well?
Over 100 nations.
Okay. And you reported, Eric, that organizers plan to seek an unspecified amount of incentives in terms of funding from county, city, and state governments for this 10-day competition. But some believe that figure will come in around $23 million. Where does that figure come from?
Well, this started, Steve reported this a couple of weeks ago. There was an economic development meeting with the city where it was revealed that $23 million is being requested in a combination of grants and in-kind services from city government. Now, at the same time, when I spoke to the organizers, I was asking them, okay, what is the split on the $23 million? They did not disclose that, said that's not available yet. But then they were also saying that county and state government are likely to be asked to contribute financially as well. And they're also hoping to get some federal security money. And again, I'll let Steve speak for himself, but this is kind of playing off this one of the stories that Steve did. What exactly is the total here? When are we going to learn the totals? What is the total combination of funding from various governments? That's what I was trying to get at.
Steve.
Yeah, and I think it'll be interesting to see when that $23 million was first disclosed, when city staff said that in that Economic Development Committee meeting, a couple of council members kind of groaned or gasped. I'm not sure what the right term is. That's a big number. I think Charlotte will end up giving something, but it'll be interesting to see what number, where they land, because one of the things, you know, Eric talked about the 10,000 athletes, which is it's a big number. It's a lot of people coming to the region to bring economic impact. I think that's certainly true. But then the question is, how many fans do you have? How many other people do you have? That number is probably not that big. And so it will be interesting to see how closely city council looks at this and how much they scrutinize this request.
Do we know what the economic impact might be?
We know that they have commissioned a study. They have not released any figures yet of projected economic impact.
And can we say no? No, thanks. We're not giving you these
incentives. You can always say no, Mike. You can always say no.
But then what happens? Are these games, what kind of games are they? Are they
mostly traditional Olympic style competitions, track and field and rafting, those kinds of things.
Okay. There's a new report from Smart Growth America that shows pedestrian deaths continue to rise locally and nationwide. They're up 75% nationally since 2010. 287 people were killed while walking in Charlotte in the 4 years from 2020 to 2024. And sustained Charlotte Shannon Binns has a theory as to why.
The streets were engineered to move vehicles as fast as possible. They weren't engineered for safety. We need to treat this like the public safety emergency that it is.
Ryan, does he have any suggestions as to what to do about it?
Yeah, I mean, there are, I've done some reporting in the past about some of the road diets and things that are carried out through our Vision Zero program. The recently passed city budget has a bigger investment in Vision Zero than years past. It's part of their priority on public safety. That doesn't get spoken about as much as maybe crime, but it's definitely a big part of our current council is definitely looking at it closely and treats it like an emergency. Somewhat.
The Order of the Longleaf Pine is an honor to recognize individuals who made a lasting impact on their communities and beyond. It's been handed out to luminaries like Billy Graham, Michael Jordan, Dale Earnhardt, Maya Angelou, Andy Griffith, Dean Smith, Harvey Gantt, Henry Bogan. This week it went to three Charlotte luminaries. Eric, who were they?
It was more than three, Mike. There were a number, probably over a dozen. Erskine Bowles, David Temper, Mayor Vi Lyles, Malcolm Coley, local businessman, and I won't go through the whole list, but they had the ceremony at Bank of America Stadium. Steve Smith, the former Panther, was honored for his philanthropic work. So, as you say, a very prestigious award.
And a big celebration this weekend in Raleigh to celebrate the Stanley Cup victory by the Carolina Hurricanes. Do they expect something similar to what happened in New York for the Knicks?
Maybe not that number, but the time, Mike, is 11 to 3 p.m., so that's a long parade.
It's a long parade. That's Eric Spanberg, managing editor of the Charlotte Business Journal, Ryan Pitkin, co-founder, editor of Queen City Nerve, Ben Thompson, anchor at WCNC TV, and Steve Harrison, our politics reporter here at WFAB News. Thank you all for the hour.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. The producer is Chris Jones. For more information on Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or to subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.